HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 152, recorded live Thursday, February 26, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik R80 Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks code generation with Kathleen Dollard.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm sitting here at the Rocky Mountain Trifecta, what I like to call the Denver Code Camp in Denver, Colorado. I'm sitting down with Kathleen Dollard, Chief Technologist at AppVenture. Thanks for sitting down with me.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So you, back in the day, many, many years ago, 50, 60 years ago in 2003, you wrote the book on code generation in .NET.
I did.
There were not a lot of .NET people doing code generation, although it's an old concept.
It is. It's a very old concept, and I've looked at it for a long time before then. But in .NET, we had the right tools to get started with it and do it in a much more profound way than we could with previous tools that I had been involved in. And so I got involved with it. I was writing my own harnesses, my own tools, and I wound up writing a book to come out of that. And it was a long time ago, and it feels like a long time ago.
Well, 2003 in the .NET space is kind of a long time ago.
Yeah, and that's when I released it. So it was most of 2002 was
really?
That was what I did, yeah.
So we as a community, the .NET community, is not mature in a number of ways, but we are, I feel like 2009 may be the year that we kind of reach some level of maturity in a number of different aspects of software, and hopefully code generation will be one of them. But how were you doing code gen back in the day in .NET?
Well, there's a couple of kind of standard problems that we have to solve when we're doing code generation. And they actually hit a couple of different areas of development. And I just want to, there's one thing I'd kind of like to say as a starting point is that what we're trying to do is make the coding better, the coding process better. And I want to use the word better instead of faster. It will be faster. That's a good thing. The quality will be better. That's a good thing. Programmers will be happy. That's a good thing. All of that's a good thing. But sometimes you also have to sit back and say, it doesn't mean my project is going to go X percent faster because it doesn't save you time in requirements. It doesn't save you time in a lot of other features that are actually a big part of your job. They're getting lost because as you shrink the coding down, all of a sudden those become bigger, they're more evident to you once that gets pulled down. But we can talk about some of those areas, but I know you've got experience in code generation as well.
Yeah, I worked for a number of years as a chief architect of a company called Carillion, now called CheckFree, and we did online banking. And along with some of my compadres and partners in crime, like Patrick Caldwell and a number of other guys, we did some code gen 2003, 2004. We were using CodeSmith at the time, and we generated maybe 30-40% of our application, but it was largely domain objects. We had a very domain-driven design. So we weren't using code generation from a rules generation perspective. We were making literally data transfer objects, but lots of them.
And that's the kind of code, when I said your coders will be happier, that's the kind of code that makes coders crazy to write. And so it's really important to recognize that we're trying to get coders focused on where coders need to be focused. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to make coding go away. It's just that we're spending time on stupidity. What we want to do is spend time on really good domain issues. We will solve more problems. We will be able to write applications we can't get to right now because we're still rewriting the mission-critical applications we started writing back in the 50s.
Exactly. The kind of code that we were generating was monkey code. It was just a bunch of monkeys, and this is not to say that my compadres were monkeys, but it was just monkeys slapping on a keyboard could write this stuff. It was properties and validation and getters and setters. But the thing that was interesting was that requirements would change subtly. And then you go and say, oh, I got to change these 400 domain objects so that they all have this behavior. Some of those behaviors can be expressed in an object hierarchy, but other ones couldn't. Then we turn to code generation because it was so repetitive.
And that's actually, you've touched on something that's really important there, and that's the fact that the long-term ability to evolve and flex a code-generated application is really one of the fundamental benefits. If we were to say, if we were to make a bullet list of the really big ones, that's really it, because either on an architectural level, somebody new comes in and says, this was stupid, why did somebody do that? We have to yank that out of there, and you have 200, 300, 400 classes that are involved, or something changes in the domain, a business change happens. And remember, these are on entirely separate timelines. So it could be that one is happening faster or slower. We just don't know what's going to change. Mm-hmm. So on the business timeline, we need a new field. We need a new table. We need some new change there. And we can quickly roll that out and quickly roll it into the application. So the ability to manage change and evolve through time is really one of the huge benefits of Generate applications. My goal is nothing less than applications that last for 20 years. We're not even close to that right now. But I do believe that that is the brass ring where we should be reaching for, mm-hmm. is being able to establish metadata-driven applications as much as possible, limiting the actual code that humans have to write to something we can find. Mm-hmm. And then we can rewrite it, and it's okay if technology changes. And then allowing technology to change through our generated architectures. That's a dream.
Now, your book is probably a little dated now, but because you're using XSLT for a lot of your code generation, but there were some principles. And since we've had Uncle Bob on talking about principles, there were 5 principles of code generation that you talked about that might not be dated.
There were 5. And actually, when I first put them out, I was a little bit nervous because the Java community in 2003 had a lot more experience than we did. So I put it out on codegeneration.net and asked the Java people what they thought. And they agreed with me, which made me very happy because the book was already impressed. it would have been a bit rough if I had totally mucked that one up, but they're still valid, and so we can go through those.
Sure.
So the first one is code generation has to be under your control being the organization or the individual. All of these, I think, have more nuances now than I put on in 2003, and one of the nuances on that is actually organizations need to have kind of a hierarchy in some cases of how generation is done. But that's sort of a separate. You can't go out and buy this. You have to be involved in the architecture yourself. And the reason is that when there's a problem, somebody's going to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first one. The second one is that metadata is discrete and morphable. And actually, metadata is a sub-genre all on its own. So I could talk for a very long time about it. But it's ultimately the model. It's ultimately how you describe what you're going to build. We think of models in terms of only our business object models. So mm-hmm. that domain model, and that's very important. But actually, the layout of our UI is also a model. Our rules engines for validation, these are also models. These are all ways that we describe at a higher level of abstraction what we actually want to build. We have to be able to get at that, work with it. It can't be buried away. It has to be morphable and changeable from one technology to another, from one source like a database.
So it needs to be agnostic to the end result.
It's agnostic. Okay. We have a long way to go on metadata. It's probably the richest area for growth that we've got.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is it has to be an easy process. I used to say it has to be one click once. I was like the reverse of Microsoft. Now I said it pretty much has to be no click. It should be part of the normal continuous integration build process. It's an evolution of the same concept.
We were doing continuous integration back in mm-hmm. the day, and we always said build.bat, test.bat.
Right.
Well, at the beginning of build.bat, we had kind of generate.bat, and we had not made it one click. But to your point, getting it into the continuous integration, it is as fundamental as doing the build.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The reason is you want to find your problems very quickly. It's the same reason you do continuous integration on any other part of your application. So that's the third one. The fourth one is that handcrafted code is sacred and protected. And I use a very strong word for a good reason, and that's that whether it was done by a mistake, and I really want to underline that, it doesn't matter if somebody blew it and made a mistake. Something done by a human being should be protected. Human beings are creative by nature. Creativity means if you come back after lunch, you may not be able to do it the same way. You have to protect it. There are very good ways to protect it. That's an area that we have the technology. Everybody's just been ignoring it for the last 6 years. So basically, the one way to address that that's very simple and can be done in CodeSmith, it can be done in T4, it can be done in any generation language that I know of, it just takes effort, is to include in the file a checksum of the file. And so you can know absolutely that that file was unchanged later. And I've been doing that since 2003.
That's really interesting. We had a big problem early on, and again, I feel silly to think that 5 years ago was a long time, but people would open up foo.cs and they'd start editing it. And then they'd be upset when the continuous integration server blew it away or generate.bat blew it away. So then we started calling them, foo.g.cs or foo.generated.cs. And we'd put giant warning messages in comments.
At the top, right?
Which they would then promptly erase. Then start writing code.
Visual Studio begs you to make that mistake. If you believe that making comments will help you not overwrite generate code, I really encourage you to ensure that that comment is every 20 lines of code. because we do not open files at the top and start reading them at the top. We get around via navigation.
And there's nothing wrong with generating comments every 20 lines or so. Well,
absolutely. If you really believe that just what we need is Visual Studio to recognize them, they will not do it
as generated and build in the checksum.
But the editor in 2010 should make it easier for us to do it.
So you're saying, and I don't know if this is controversial or not, but you're saying that if somebody breaks the rules, busts open some generated code, you'd rather have a warning or break the build or something than to have them lose their little bit of human-generated bits.
Absolutely. That's a build break. You break your build, and you actually could break it at it kind of a warning level, perhaps, because you don't really know how deep that went into the system. But your process is broken, just like it would be if anything else went wrong. So you absolutely should break the build at that point.
Okay, so how many principles
is that? Four.
Okay,
and so number five is kind of self-evident, but it is that generated code should be of equal or better quality than non-generated code. And it's really, we have opportunities and we should take advantage of them once we go to generated code. So there was two small caveats that also got added, one of which I totally blew in my work. I'm trying to make amends, which is it should be simple. People that have ever looked at my work will laugh right now. And the other one is that it should pay back on the first project. And so those are kind of just asides that have kind of gotten added into the picture. The payback on the first project, we go so fast now, I don't think anyone would seriously consider making an investment that took them three projects to make it back. But that's real. We have to be agile in code generation. It's my belief that they make a good fit.
You know, and it's interesting. This is a little bit of a side trip, but a lot of the people in the, not just the .NET community, but in the overall software community tend to be consultants. The loudest ones are consultants. So this means the blog that you read is not always a guy or gal who's suffering for 10 years on an IT system. I always talk about this canonical character. I call him the chief architect of the Nebraska Department of Forestry. Okay. He's usually not blogging. He's trying to do actual work.
Right.
That the people that we, that you, the listener, listen to, may be doing short-term consulting projects. They may be coming in. It's a little off color, but I usually call it sex without the commitment. It's the one-night stand of software. They leave. Who's going to raise this baby? Who's going to put this child through college? I did this for 6 years. I would fly in. I would whiteboard for money. I would, the great white hope. Ta-da! And I would leave. But a lot of those early systems in the mid-90s that I was working on weren't as flexible and didn't have longevity that they should have had. And I think that we need to remember that when we're listening to loud bloggers, consultants, speakers, whoever. And I think that...
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, when was the last time you were on a five-year-long project?
I actually do maintain long commitments with some of my clients.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an ongoing relationship with them?
I do have with some of my clients, not all of my clients, because I do training in code generation. And when I do that, it often is a good luck, call me if you need me. And sometimes I don't maintain those relationships. Mm-hmm. But it is important that all of us maintain that vision. And it's not just code generation. Code generation is one piece of the puzzle. It's a matter of writing code that is going to evolve. We are taking it as a matter, we're accepting it as a matter of course that technology will change so much that we're just going to have to rewrite in 5 years anyway. So why worry about the 5-year time frame?
Exactly.
And that is just, it's an unacceptable long-term strategy. It is true in the short term.
Right.
But it's unacceptable.
And I think that code generation is an opportunity, but it's not an opportunity to be sloppy.
No, it's absolutely.
And some
not.
People use it as, it's generated code, doesn't have to be pretty.
Yeah.
I've said that.
Yeah. I've definitely seen systems like that. And it's, there's some areas you can actually be sloppy in.
Sure.
For example, if you're wasting your time adjusting white space, I think you're absolutely just doing that wasting your time.
Agreed.
But because you can pretty print it later. But in terms of actually writing true good quality code, it's very important.
Now, there's a number of ways these days in .NET and Visual Studio to generate code. There's lots of products to use. But one of the things that's been getting a lot of press lately is T4, this newly discovered, but been around for a long time, 3-4 years.
Yeah.
Things hidden in Visual Studio.
That's right. It used to be called T3. I don't know which T is new, but I this is like a test. It's a text templating transformation toolkit.
Toolkit. This is the fourth T.
Yeah. And so they added another T, and it is an acronym, but it's an acronym. When they go to the next version, I'm kind of hoping they don't find another T and make it T5, but who knows what they'll do. Yes, it's on your listeners' machines if they're running 2008. And most people have no idea that they have a code generation language on their machine right here, right now.
Not an add-in. This is not something that they had to check when they installed Visual Studio. If you are listening and you run 2008, you have this right now.
Right, you do. Except.
Except.
Except. There's a couple of big excepts on this. It's It's not altogether clear to me what the strategy within Microsoft that got it into Visual Studio is, but they gave it to you without a little icon. You can't go in and just say, create a new item,
right.
T4 template.
Add new item.
Okay, you can't do that. So that's missing. An editor is missing. There's no editing capabilities within Visual Studio itself.
Right.
And they didn't give you a harness. And we can kind of come back and talk about harnesses because the other two are pretty self-evident. The first one is easy. You create a text file. Mm-hmm. You change the extension. If you want to see output within Visual Studio, so if you want Visual Studio to turn around and display when you say view this, you're going to actually be able to see output. And the way it actually appears is it's a sub item the way that other...
Like designers. You have like designers. The whatever, and then you have the dot designer.
Right. So if you give it the extension .tt, then Visual Studio will create a sub... A subfile is a .cs or .vb file, which contains the output. It has some limitations, primarily the way data parameters are passed in. So that can be somewhat, it may or may not be useful. It's very useful to learn T4. You can also give it another extension that you simply know later. We use T4, and that's just an extension. I don't want Visual Studio to do that because it's only going to get confused when that template starts trying to evaluate parameters, which I can talk about some of the problems about that related to the harness. So you can solve that problem. You can make Visual Studio do generation for you today, right now. You'll be doing it in an editor that looks like Notepad if you just use Visual Studio. And hopefully within the, we have an answer now, and hopefully we'll have another one in the 2010 timeframe.
Hi, this is Scott coming at you from another place in time. Are you looking for an object relational mapping tool for mission-critical projects using Link and .NET? I wanted to share with you Genome. It's specifically designed for developing .NET Enterprise applications. Genome is a mature Link-integrated ORM tool. It's been employed in numerous large-scale projects over the last 6 years. Genome was created for the .NET platform as opposed to being a port from Java. And it's thrived on platform innovation since .NET 1.0. Genome has supported Link since its CTP release in May of 2006. It offers several unique features, such as encapsulation and reuse of Link queries and expressions. You can really fully harness the power of Link while benefiting from your database platform's unique features. Compose complex Link queries, decompose the query logic in your domain model. Link supports all the major database platforms you find in enterprise environments like SQL Server, but also Oracle and IBM DB2. You can find out more about how Genome integrates tightly with Visual Studio and what tools Genome offers to reduce development time at tinyurl.com/trygenome, G-E-N-O-M-E, where you can also download a free and fully functional trial version. I hope you enjoy it. So now in 2008, I say file new text file.
Uh-huh.
I call it foo.tt.
Uh-huh.
I add a couple of lines and people can search the web and find T4 tutorials. It'll tell you the directive that you need to put up, the name of the output file, and they can start writing what looks like ASP code.
Well, yes and no. What they write as just raw text is just going to be printed out as it is. There's different types of, directives, different types of elements you can put in there, many of which drop you into getting expressions, one of which drops you into the code that you want the language written in, which can be either VB or C#, could probably be other stuff. But
it's text. You could generate CSV files or XML or whatever makes you happy.
Absolutely. So we have a language within the template. It's one of the things that takes a minute to get used to. There's a language within the template that runs the template. For example, you want to do something for every property in your business object. You have a loop, and that loop is logic and code within the template that runs the template. Then the template is going to output something. That could be VB or C# code. It could be a configuration file. It could be XAML. It could be anything that is a text file that you want to get put out onto your file system.
And they hit, Control-Shift-B, and it happens. That thing gets generated.
Yes.
Now, that happens in Visual Studio. I understand that it doesn't happen at MS Build level. There's some MS Build tasks you need to build in to make sure that happens at the command line.
Yeah, and I'm afraid I'm not that familiar with the MS Build
sure.
stuff on that, because T4 is sort of it's all just coming together for us right now. I actually use an external harness myself, and that's something I want to talk a little bit about. But before we go there, we mentioned an editor, and we didn't mention the solution for people. There's a company called Clarius, and you'll have the URL
sure.
On the notes for the podcast.
And Clarius is C-L-A-R-I-U-S.
Yes.
And one of the primaries over there is a buddy of mine named Daniel Canzolino. Everyone calls him Kazoo. KZU. So if you search for KZU and T4 or search around for T4, you will inevitably bump into these guys. They're all over.
Yeah, T4 Editor, I believe.
T4 Editor?
Searching for T4 Editor will get you right
Fantastic.
There.
Fantastic.
And they have a community edition. I'd really like to thank the folks for Claris for doing that for you because I'd hate for everybody to have to invest $100. But you know what? If you're doing this all the time, I think you should seriously consider going ahead and getting the full copy. But in terms of just getting started, no, you don't need that. There is a community preview edition.
So this gives you what? IntelliSense and syntax highlighting and all the stuff that you don't get in Visual Studio.
Right. And there's more in there's more of that in the version that's $100, which is
version.
A very reasonable price.
Sure.
But in the coloring is tremendously important because, as I said, you have two languages going on at once. The one that you're outputting, the one you're writing your template
right.
in. And if they're the same color, good luck.
Yeah. We did that in Notepad back in the day, and it was always challenging because just as when you're making web pages, you're thinking about the HTML you're producing, and then you're thinking about the inline script. If the inline script happens to be the same language as what you're generating, if you're using VB to generate VB or vice versa, it can be very, very eye-blurring as to what's happening.
Coloration is tremendously important on that.
Yeah.
Coloration pretty much solves that problem.
So you said a harness. Why do I need
right.
a harness?
Okay, so a harness is basically something that's going to run the template. And T4, as it stands right now, doesn't take parameters. It's rather primitive in its relationship with the rest of the world. And that's because there's a model within DSL, which is where T4 came out of. Microsoft didn't sit back and say, we want to build a templating engine. What they set back and said is, we want to build DSL, and you cannot
do domain-specific languages.
Yes, thank you. Domain-specific languages. And to support that, we must do generation. So within the domain-specific language world, there's space for interacting with the T4 templates. And so because of that, it's a little bit awkward. One of the harnesses that is the first prototype is available right now, but I'll be putting up in the next week a much more sophisticated version at adventure.com. We have a community edition, which is free. We're putting it up there so people can get used to T4. And what that's going to let you do is actually manage properties being handed into your T4 template. You create a dictionary. The dictionary gets handed off to this engine. The engine does the work to get that data into the template. So getting properties passed is one of the things you need a harness to do. You need harnesses to manage errors. You need harnesses to manage crossing some sort of an IEnumerable. So there's other ways to solve this problem. It's been documented how to go within T4 and have a T4 file create many, many different files from itself. But I find that to be sort of confusing and the wrong tool to do the job. So what the harnesses I've been working with for years, I've been writing harnesses for many years. I've written a couple of them, and this is the best one by far. I'm really happy with it. But what this one will let you do is it will loop across a collection. So, for example, if you're describing your business model, it's going to loop across your objects so that you're going to be able to do something and create a new file across each object. These are the kinds of problems that a harness is required.
So to put that into a more concrete, if I could pause for a second, that if you have a code generation template, perhaps you're going to loop over some database tables or a custom domain specific language that you have created during some domain driven design, maybe a text file or a custom DSL that you've written. You're going to want to spin through those and then spit out actual concrete classes. Like, for example, in Link to SQL, there's a designer, a visual designer, DBML file, and you say build, and then a giant epically sized dot designer file pops out, right? You know, megabyte plus of .cs code.
And your readers can't see the face I just made because I hate that one file per problem approach. I really want a one file per entity approach because that's, or whatever it is you're creating. I don't mean entity in the formal sense there, but that's the way we write code.
Right.
And where possible generated code should look like.
Exactly. And this all depends on how you decide to structure your T4 templates. But what you were saying earlier was that by default, T4 kind of has a one template, one generated file technique.
Right, it does.
And there are ways to expand that. For example, Damien Gard has released a T4 open source template that is basically a wholesale replacement for the Link to SQL generation stuff. He generates one entity per file, but he does it with T4 and some tricks he's got to basically allow T4 to fan out. And you're saying that you're not a huge fan of that because it speaks to how the template itself is structured.
It does. It really gets back to the single responsibility principle. So what we're doing right there in what Damien's doing, and I take my hat off to Damien. And I'm really happy that those techniques are out there for everybody
to
look at.
Big smooches to Damien.
Big smooches. But I don't want a template whose job it is to produce code to also be managing files.
Yes.
That doesn't work for me. And that's why the harness that I've written steps back from that. It has an output service, and the output service manages how we're going to get it. It's got file naming services and output services. So all that stuff is pluggable. And for me, we have to step back into .NET to make those things happen. So we're not going to do it in T4.
So putting words in your mouth, are you saying that your harness is acting as like a T4 code generation pipeline? It's rather than just a simple transformation from a bunch of inputs, some output, and this magic supercontroller template does all the work. You've made a pipeline with pluggable units at every point.
That's absolutely true. Okay. That's absolutely true. Every point I could think of it, I put that in, and it'll be an open source thing. So I'm hoping we're going to get more suggestions for other ways to make it pluggable. The key things that after 8 years in this, I know we need pluggable are going to be naming services because people are all over the map in what they need in that. File output services because there's many techniques. There's ways to protect code. There's other things, the checksum that I mentioned earlier. And then the templates themselves. I don't know what templates somebody else is going to want to write, and they're going to need to interact with metadata. So they're going to need to interact with some sort of a model. I don't know what that model is going to look like. And for me to prescribe any interface or any piece anywhere in that system is not the right way to manage the problem. Mm-hmm. So what I've done instead is I know you've had Glenn Block on to talk about
MEF. Everybody loves MEF.
I'm a MEF user. He's my MEF dealer. You know, all
he's
that
your MEF dealer?
He's my MEF dealer. It's a really good example of where MEF can really shine because it allows everybody to be a consumer or a provider. And so the whole relationship among templates and metadata and services that they require, all I'm doing is hooking that up and showing people enough that they get the idea. But then my hope is people would just go to town on it. And that's why, you know, this is an appropriate community release for us because it's a tool for people to take and go forward with. Obviously we love what we're doing internally, but that's really separate from us wanting to see the world doing a lot more code generation.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I, as someone who did code generation for years, would say that kind of the two biggest problems are on the right side of the problem, deciding what I'm going to generate. And then on the left side of the problem, deciding from what I am going to generate it from. And is the thing on the left side, that metadata, simpler to write than the thing that I just want to get?
And you just did a beautiful job of explaining why this is hard. People want code generation to be easy. What they want to do is they want to say, give me the tool. I'll pay money for it. Do whatever. Give me the tool that just makes my application happen. And the problem is architecture is still hard. Mm-hmm. Metadata is still hard. These problems are still hard. They will be for a while. And you've got to be involved with that, or you're selling your soul to whoever's giving you your architecture.
Well, and that's why tools that look at the database and just generate everything from the database are so popular.
That's right. And we go both directions on that. We also have tools that are domain and create.
Start at the middle and go left and right.
Exactly. But the part in the middle, the mapping, I do it in it. I would now call it a DSL, except it's all XML. And I've been doing that for 8 years. Mm-hmm. It's in my book, how to do that mapping. It's been there for a very long time. We now don't like doing it in XML. Now we do it in DSL. But it's the same problem of how do we say this business object represents these columns from these joined objects sitting out in that database over there. And how do we make that definition? So those are all problems that are really core. The metadata problem I think we'll solve in the next 3 or 4 years. I'm really optimistic. Mm-hmm. The architecture problem, I'm not an architect. I mean, I do architecture. Sure. I copy other people's architectures, but I'm not one who has enough experience to say, yes, there is that perfect architecture we will all be able to use.
Now, this might come out of left field, but while we're here talking about things that I find very, fairly concrete and fairly, at least within the realm of understanding for me, there's this thing looming. There's this Oslo that's out there that a lot of people are still trying to get their heads around. And I'm seeing, it's almost like blind men trying to describe an elephant, and you feel, oh, this feels like a snake and that feels like a tree, but we're feeling different parts of the elephant and no one's really seeing the big picture, at least not people, unless they've dove full on into Oslo. You're describing these DSLs. Are they solving this problem as well? And how's T4 going to fit into that?
Well, I don't know exactly how everything is going to fit together at the end of the day. I think that I still have a lot to learn on that. I'm very excited about Oslo because to me what Oslo is a wonderful, big, beautiful repository for metadata. Mm-hmm. Gives us some opportunities for consistency across metadata, gives us some opportunities for rules, gives us some really exciting opportunities there. From my perspective, it's enough because I can do the rest. It's easy once we do that. Architecture's still hard, but the actual physical act of generation, we've known how to do for a while. So if they do it right and I'm happy with it, that's even better. But if they just give me the tools to create really good metadata, then that is tremendously powerful. And one of the nice things, at least in some spaces, they're accepting, workflow is one that they're doing this, the need for both textual and visual representations. And hopefully that's going to, you know, be really pervasive throughout Oslo.
Now, if people are going to sit down right now and learn about code generation, where do they start? I mean, there's the tools, there's the act of turning the crank and doing that. But there's the concepts, there's the architecture, there's the big stuff. Are there other tools that are lying out there that I should be using? Is there only T4? I know that there's CodeSmith, but what else can I use to generate code, and where do I start?
There's a couple. There's a couple out there, and there's a couple third-party tools, which I'll just skip over only because they're third-party right now, and I don't want to say anything bad or good about them. They're there. You can go search for them and find them. Microsoft has another one, though, that nobody knows about, or very few people know about.
You're just a Microsoft shill, aren't you? You don't even work for
today
the man.
Today I am. Okay. Well, you know, it's just,
there's lots of tools out there. There's LLBL Gen.
There's CodeSmith. There's CodeBreeze.
CodeBreeze. Yeah, Miguel Castro's CodeBreeze.
There's a ton of them out there, which is why I hesitate to say any, because I know I just left out three. Well, I know I left out my generation. I know. I'll sit here and just keep thinking of the ones I left off. And so, everybody, I forgot. I'm really sorry. Microsoft's other one is actually in VB9. And this has been written about. I actually did not I wish I'd discovered this on my own because it'd make me feel very smart. I first saw this from Beth, who heard it from somebody else.
Beth Massey.
So this has been out there. And I've actually done quite a bit of work on this because from this, I was actually able to create templates that were a single template that could generate either C# or VB code without the code DOM. Now, I'm not sure that work actually has a future, but that's work I did about a year ago.
So let me stop because you're talking really fast and using a lot of terms that not everyone will understand. One of the things that we used to do when we were generating code was we would create a thing called a code DOM. And a code DOM was a language agnostic way to express instructions. It was almost like building an XML document using only DOM instructions. It was just as obtuse, except we were building method calls and property getter setters and descriptions of classes using a bunch of Lego pieces that were object creation.
And the best thing to say about the code DOM is to stay as far away from it as possible.
It was, to call it Baroque would be an understatement.
Yes.
But it did allow you to do it in a language agnostic way and spit out either C# or VB. T4 is text to text, so you have to make a declaration to yourself about what you're going to generate.
Well, the declaration that you can make two declarations in T4 about the prefix you put on the output file and on the language of the template itself. Mm-hmm. But by nature of writing the code, you are saying whether it's VB or C#. You're putting in imports or using and all the other keywords.
So back to what you were saying, this scandalous bit of information that you're telling me that there's a code generation tool inside of Visual Basic 9.
Yes. Okay. So
and as a reformed VBer, see, there's nothing worse than a reformed.
Yes.
Because I was VB. That was where I started out. You know, I did my C in high school and college. Then I was VB3.
Right.
Then I became a semicolon person.
Yes.
And now I get hassled by the community when I don't give VB their props.
And I actually, I cross-code in both languages. So I'm actually giving talks right now on cross-coding.
Really?
So, yes.
Cool.
But back to VB9 in this. What we've got is XML literals. And if you code in any language and do not understand XML literals in VB9, you are selling yourself short. Mm-hmm. Go learn about it. So there's a very powerful language for creating something. It's generally
XML. Creating XML?
It's generally XML. And in fact, you are initially creating XML, but there is a very important property called dot value. What dot value does is take all of the inner XML and concatenates it into a string. You have just created source code or anything else you want to create.
So what's the XML around it for? Just
because you have to have it to make XML literals
work. That sounds like a code
work.
Generation hack. Like you're declaring
it's beautiful, though.
It is.
It really is beautiful.
So where
really
is there a sample I can go see?
I've got some stuff on my blog.
Okay.
Beth Massey's had stuff a while ago on her blog. There's a number of VB people that are using this. Steel Price has been working on an article, and I really hope that article is going to be coming up in Visual Studio mm-hmm. Magazine very soon. I'm hoping I'm not speaking out of school to that. Billy Hollis has spoken about this. A number of people have been speaking about it.
I love Billy Hollis.
Yeah. I do it more complicated, than uh-huh. some other folks do, but it's a really powerful mechanism because you're sitting in the heart of .NET.
Right.
You have got every possible tool. You can make the deepest hierarchies. You can use as much complexity as you need. Mm-hmm. You can call into subroutines. It's all in all the IntelliSense, you're in .NET.
It's difficult to describe these kind of things when you're on a podcast.
I know.
But, and I've blogged about this as well. You can go to my blog and click on the VB category, and I've shown about if ever there were a reason for a C-sharp person to get back involved in VB or to even do mixed language assemblies, it is XML literals. It's the kind of thing where the purist might say, oh my God, what have we done? We've built in one language support deep into another language. But, you know, once you accept the existence of link, a language within a language, or at least a query structure within a language, having XML embedded in a language is pretty amazing. And I've written applications where I would have a VBDLL just for the generation of XML. There's just really no easier way in .NET to generate XML.
And you know, I think it's kind of cool we talk about mixed language DLLs, but I actually like the current scenario, and I like it because if you're touching XML, mm-hmm. then you're touching a schema, and if you're touching a schema, the schema can change, put it in a different DLL.
Hmm.
So I think there's a very good reason for that boundary change,
yeah.
and the amount of actual VB code that a C# coder has to write is pretty small.
Yeah.
You know, the rest of it is it's
well,
XML
it doesn't really
literals.
Look like, you're right, it doesn't really look like VB because you're really focused on generating your XML. Or as a lot of examples we've been seeing lately with ASP.NET MVC, there's been some examples where we've had XML literals generating XHTML. So mm-hmm. VB XML literals as view engine.
Right.
As a strongly typed way to generate an entire web page or RSS feed or whatever makes you happy.
Right. But if you just imagine putting inside of those XML elements, putting some inner text that was what you wanted to appear mm-hmm. Eventually, and it can be nested in whatever pattern you want because it's simply concatenated on a top to bottom basis within the XML file, mm-hmm. then you are able to create any kind of output that you want, whether it was XML
or not,
just by putting dot value at the end.
All right. Well, I want to see this to believe it. I want to see if it's performant and if it's something I'm going to play with. So hopefully we'll put in the show notes a link to some examples on your blog and some of the other examples that we've talked about today.
Sounds good.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Kathleen Dollard, for sitting down and talking with me today. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.